In the rainy season, river traders used to come up the Maisi River on a daily basis in search of Brazil nuts, rosewood, and other jungle products. The routine was always the same. In the distance, I heard the putt-putt-putt of their diesel engine. I knew if they were going to stop because I'd hear the ding of the signal bell, the pilot letting the engine operator know when to slow the boat down. I learned early on that it was considered rude to decline invitations to go and say hello, never mind that 3 to 6 boats could stop on a busy day, and each one took at least half an hour to tell me their business. It wasn't that I minded the conversations with these men. On the contrary, I quite enjoyed talking with them. But I dreaded their approach because they interrupted my research. One night, a boat I had not seen before came to the village. The pirahas yelled that the owner's name was Ronaldinho. Of course, he wanted to see me, so I got up and went on board to talk to him. From the outset, his operation looked suspicious. There wasn't a single trade item in sight. I sat at one end of the empty vessel, Ronaldinho sat at the other end, with pirahas sitting around the sides of the deck. "I want to know if I can take about 8 men upriver with me to collect Brazil nuts," he said. "You don't need to ask me, ask the pirahas," I replied. Then I added something that the Brazilian National Indian Foundation had asked that I tell these traders. "The only thing that the law requires is that you pay them the minimum wage for their labor." "But I have no money," Ronaldinho replied. "You can pay them in trade items," I suggested. "But you cannot pay them in cachaça, sugarcane rum. If you give them alcohol, you can be punished with as much as 2 years in prison."
"Oh, I would never give them alcohol, Mr. Daniel," Ronaldinho promised. Baloney, I thought. But I said only that I was going to bed.
My sleep was disturbed periodically by laughing from his boat. They talked pretty much like drinking men anywhere in the world. My cowboy dad's behavior when he was drunk was just like this. Then, at about midnight, I was woken up by yelling. The words that first impressed themselves on my senses were, "I am not afraid to kill the Americans. The Brazilian says to kill them. He will give us a new shotgun. I will shoot them while they are sleeping." This discussion was coming from the jungle darkness less than 100 feet from my house. I realized that most of the men from the village were drunk on cachaça. They were talking about killing us. I pulled back my mosquito net from our bed and left the house in the dark. I stepped carefully through the jungle to the hut where the men were working up their emotions to kill us. Peering through the palm board slats, I saw them sitting by the flickering light of a lamp. I knew that something was likely to happen very soon if I didn't act. I caught my breath silently outside, trying to decide how to enter in the least confrontational way. Finally, I just walked inside with a big smile and said in my best piraha, "Hey guys, how are you doing?" I made small talk while I walked around the hut, picking up arrows, bows, 2 shotguns, and a couple of machetes. The piraha men stared at me with dull, alcohol-laden eyes. I walked out quickly into the dark. But I was still worried. Back at our house, I locked my wife Karen and the children in our storeroom, the one room that had walls and a door. Then I walked down the river towards the boat. Suddenly, I heard my language teacher, Ko'oi's voice, from the bushes on the bank just beside me. "I am going to shoot you right now. I kill you." I turned, fully expecting to receive the blast of his 20-gauge shotgun. He came toward me out of the bushes unsteadily, but I could see with relief that he was not armed. "Why do you want to kill me?" I asked.
"Because the Brazilian says that you told him he could not pay us if we worked for him."
If I had not been able to speak piraha, I might not have survived the night. I struggled and focused as never before to put each thought across clearly to Ko'oi and explained. The Brazilian had told me he had no money. He wanted to pay you in alcohol because it's cheap. It'd cost him more if he paid you in supplies like guns, sugar, or milk, like I asked him. "Wow," said Ko'oi. "The foreigner is stealing from us. The piraha don't want him."
Then I heard my wife's voice. Karen had come down to the riverbank to see what I was doing. A few men were pushing her from side to side, moving her closer and closer to the water. I sprinted over. I was no longer a missionary, a linguist, or even a nice person. I was ready to hurt someone. The men backed off, muttered incoherent drunken words, and walked back into the darkness. It was then that I noticed the whole village was completely dark. The women had thrown dirt on the fires that normally burned constantly in each hut, and had gone into the jungle to hide from their own husbands. I told Karen to get back into the storeroom, and she readily agreed. I walked up to the house with her, and as she went in, I picked up one of the shotguns I had just taken from the Pirahas. I checked to make sure that it wasn't loaded, and took a seat on a bench to guard my family. Several men started toward the house during the night, but I could hear others warn them, "Dan's got lots of weapons now." Eventually, they began to lose interest in us, arguing with each other. Finally, I got too tired, and at about 4 a.m, I retreated to the storeroom myself, where I hoped to sleep for an hour or two. I could hear Pirahas coming into our house and fighting. At dawn, we emerged cautiously and saw their blood spattered on the walls in every room. But no one came toward us now. Men wobbled by, purposely steering wide of our house. Later in the day, after they'd slept off most of their drunkenness, the Piraha men came into our house to apologize. Ko'oi spoke for the men. "We're sorry. Our heads get really bad when we drink. We do things that are bad." "Look, you guys can drink or do anything you want," I said. "This is Piraha land. But if you want me here, you can't threaten to kill me and scare my children, okay?" "Okay," they replied as a chorus. "We will not scare you or kill you." But in spite of the apology, one of the Piraha, Ahuabasis, still seemed angry and sullen. "Are you mad at me?" I asked. "You told Brazilians not to sell us alcohol." "Yes," I admitted. "Your women told me not to let anyone sell alcohol to you." "You are not a Piraha," he declared. "You do not tell me that I cannot drink. This is the Piraha's jungle. We want you to stay, but you don't tell us what to do." I realized that I had misinterpreted the Piraha's perception of my role among them. I thought that they saw me, the missionary, as a protector and authority figure. I had jeopardized my good relationship with the Piraha men. There is no official coercion in Piraha society. No police, courts, or chiefs. Spirits tell the villagers what they should or should not do. Pirahas listen carefully and often follow the exhortations of the spirits. One Saturday morning, I was woken by a crowd gathering on the riverbank about 20 feet to the right of my house. They were energetically gesticulating and yelling, "Everybody come and see Igagai, quickly. He is on the beach." I found Ko'oi, my teacher, and asked him what was going on. "Don't you see him over there?" he asked impatiently. "Igagai, one of the beings that lives above the clouds, is standing on the beach yelling at us, telling us he will kill us if we go to the jungle." "Where?" I asked. "I don't see him."
"Right there,"
Ko'oi snapped, looking intently toward the middle of the apparently empty beach. In the jungle with the Pirahas, I regularly failed to see wildlife they saw. My inexperienced eyes just weren't able to see as theirs did. But this was different. Even I could tell that there was nothing on that white, sandy beach. And yet, as certain as I was about this, the Pirahas were equally certain that there was something there. I heard Christine, my 6-year-old daughter, at my side. "What are they looking at, Daddy?" "I don't know. I can't see anything." She was as puzzled as I was. Christine and I left the Pirahas and walked back to our house. What had I just witnessed? I could never have proved to the Pirahas that the beach was empty, and they could never have convinced me that there was anything, much less a spirit, on it. Ever since, I have tried to come to grips with the significance of how two cultures could see reality so differently. On many rainless nights, a high falsetto voice can be heard from the jungle near a Piraha village. It sounds spirit-like, and indeed it's taken by the Pirahas to be a kawaboge, or fast mouth. The voice gives the villagers suggestions and advice. One night I walked through the bush about 100 feet to the source of that night's voice. The man talking was Agabi, someone known to be very interested in spirits. "Mind if I record you?" I asked, not knowing how he might react. "Sure, go ahead," he answered, immediately in his normal voice. The next day, I went to his place and asked, "Why were you talking like a kawaboge last night?" He acted surprised. "Did a spirit come last night? I didn't hear one. But then I wasn't here." Very puzzling, I thought. In my experience, this is not the same as shamanism, because there was no one man among the Piraha who could speak for or to the spirits. Some men did this more frequently than others, but any Piraha man could, and over the years I was with them, most did, speak as a spirit in this way. Pirahas see spirits in their mind literally. They talk to spirits literally. Whatever anyone else might think of these claims, all Pirahas will say that they experience spirits who've told them things like, "Don't hunt down river tomorrow," or things that are commonly shared values such as, "Don't eat snakes." Through spirits, their society disciplines itself. I asked the Pirahas once during my early missionary years if they knew why I was there. "You are here because this is a beautiful place. The water is pretty. There are good things to eat. The Pirahas are nice people." That was and is their perspective. Life is good. Their upbringing, everyone learning early on to pull their own weight, produces a society of satisfied members. That is hard to argue against. My own impression is that the Pirahas are happier, fitter, and better adjusted to their environment than any Christian or any religious person I have ever known. Indeed, I had begun to question my own role as a missionary out to convert these people, and even my faith in God.